Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Wonderful evening. It's the privilege and responsibility of the lawyers of each generation, as you very well know, to face the new problems to which their society is exposed. It rests on our shoulders and not somebody else's shoulders. This is the leitmotif of what I'm going to say. Our generation includes the new global threat of terrorism and violence, identified by the Secretary General in the slide I now show you. This is a bit of a rerun of what happened rather a long time ago when I was reading international law. And there was a thing called the Cuban crisis, which was quite exciting at the time. I'm not going to read the what's on the screen. You can read it for yourself. But the fact that this dynamic man has expressed himself in this fashion is troubling. There follows a bigger bit with him and the president of the World Bank about, and if you look down to the second last paragraph, the need to address grievances around exclusion from access to power. That word is what this conference is all about. Because we're faced with threats of abuse of power, power to injure, abuse of human rights, and abuse of the environment. Our task is to use our, and by that I mean the legal community, right across the whole board, our knowledge, our skills, experience, and imagination to bring the power of the law to bear to create and maintain decency for both the globe and its inhabitants, and not just the human bits. The responsibility of our profession was summed up in his retiring speech by the Dutch Chief Justice in two words, for which, interestingly, he selected the French language. He said, "We need sensitivité et audace." Sensitivity requires hard work to identify who is suffering, why that is happening, and what can be done about it. Courage, his other word, requires no explanation, but includes taking on unpopular challenges rather than shrugging one shoulder, looking away from it, leaving it all to others, as the legal profession has done throughout history much too often. And this group is an extraordinary, carefully selected bunch of people who have the intelligence and imagination to know exactly what I'm saying. And the example we had last night of what inspiration can do is something that we need to take on board in our own work and not just bury our head in some research or the intricacies of some current case, but continue to stand on the mountaintop, look around 360 degrees and think, what is it that could be done? What could be done better? Now, this sounds like a sermon from a geriatric judge, and indeed it is, because after 50 years in our profession, I have learned what happens if you have those who act, who think, and stick their necks out, and those who do not, and allow things to drag on. As happened, as we learnt in New Delhi not long ago, that the subjection of women to an instant talaq divorce had been around 1400 years because nothing had been done to change the law. And that's a classic example of what I'm complaining about. It was the combination of those two qualities of sensitivity and courage that brought about what the English Court of Appeal has recently described in the Belhage case that's still running in England. the fundamental change within public international law, it looks as though this has been a kind of self-orchestrating process. It's happened like a glacial flow. It's nothing of the kind. What has given rise to this change of international law from when I took it as a student to what Jeremy Bentham spoke about, the fact of there being an international law, not just interstate law, was picked up, as we know so well, by the heroes and heroines of our profession. Over the years, they were thinkers, prepared to look at the facts, to identify solutions, stand up and make it happen. If you look at the UN Charter, particularly the preamble, where human rights gets a pretty good airing, didn't get dealt too terribly much there, that came later. But human rights is now fully fledged. It's our job to take it seriously, but when you have 65 million people who are displaced on this planet, three times the number that there were just over a decade ago, when I heard the then Human Rights Commissioner complaining about this in another part of this country, it's outrageous, it is terrifying, and it's something that is not being taken sufficiently seriously. Our international law, and particularly international criminal law, have had some wonderful things happen over a certain period. But this is what Sir Robert Jennings said when he was interviewed by the great Cassese in 23 years ago. International law is singularly lacking in developed adult, grown-up machinery for international political decision. It's inadequate compared with the machinery you'd find in any state for executive and administrative political decision making, and so on and so on. We all know that. But what Jennings was getting at is not the details of machinery, but the result of there being an insufficient will and process for law to do its job. Its job is to serve the community by ensuring that the new problems, we get them every year, and these days every day, the law must handle those problems. That's why the law was developed. It didn't just grow like Topsy. It was created by the equivalents of you folk over the years, over the centuries. And we've had the great people who've done it, as well as the other ones I have mentioned. Now, while, as I say, much good has been done on various fronts of international criminal law, the need for a greater effort has never been more urgent. I set aside other urgent current threats, of which we're all too aware, and they include, of course, the environment, cyber, this and that, and much else, and focus on terrorism for two reasons. One is because of its own importance, and also because it exemplifies classically our current failures of imagination and nerve as the legal experts of our community. We're just not exercising our legal power to serve our people adequately. It's sobering to think of how power in a wide range of disciplines has been exercised in this city over the decades, over the centuries, to change the world. And it was inspirational to set this conference about power in this city, in this room, at this time. We've discussed Dante, Machiavelli, Michelangelo, the Medici. We were inspired last night by what we saw. And their genius is inspirational, but we should be inspired not only to marvel, open our mouths and say, golly, isn't it great, but actually to think what the authors of those things have done. It takes effort to achieve the statue we saw last night, a lot of planning, as we heard. Well, that's not within our profession. We're not expected to do that. But the things we are expected to do, we're not doing, or not doing properly. And those within it, and not least the professor of the University of Florence, Antonio Cassese, whose sensitivity and audace have pointed where we should take international criminal law in relation to terrorism, is something we need to get on with. The need to use that international crime, I use the adjective deliberately, it is international, despite what some chain draggers have been making of it. As you'll see in a moment when I talk about the Security Council, which is one of the standard setters, one of the people with creatures with power, which needs to be properly exercised, and being party to the crime, funders of terrorism, are as much terrorists as those who commit the actual act. There is no gluing together of a substantive crime of international terrorism and being party to that crime as a funder. Instead, we have legislation against funders. We have 193 different statutes about terrorism, but where's the overarching global measure that would make terrorism a crime which has the response of a united nations? There should be 193 hands pulling on a single rope to throttle terrorism. The legal issues include what role can international law play in pursuing terrorism, and as I've indicated, why not view terrorist conduct in total perspective? That's what we do everywhere else, but why hasn't this been thought of, given effect? Now, there's debate about how the significance of terrorism. The quotations here give Andrew Parker, the head of MI5, a terrifying expression on the 18th of October. Simon Jenkins in The Guardian was for taking it more gently, see the bottom line, terrorist killings are appalling, not threats to national security. Well, wherever you take it, the fact is terrorism terrifies communities. It has us delayed at the airport, all the other things. It needs a response. Now, I come to what the US ambassador said on the debate in relation to the creation of the new court, the ICC. And I quote him, "This is not a place for the elaboration of new and unprecedented criminal law." Well, that's always said. Very likely it had politically to be said, because this was a very valuable development which is of immense value, even if it's not a total one. But it's a warning sign when you see words like that used. But what he then said, and this is what I emphasize, despite the caution that he felt bound to exercise, he said, "If all goes well, the international community can and will build on our initial efforts, and the court will evolve and grow." Now, how much of that have we really seen over the last 20 years? That's a long time, and that's the period during which the terrorist threats, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, plenty of others, and there's more to come, that's the forecast, that's why Parker speaks as he did, has not been responded to effectively. Now, fortunately, there is a different way to approach these things, and this is what Vice President Yusuf said in a recent address in this city in honour of Cassese. "Happily, there are some international lawyers who recognise the ephemeral nature of legal rules." Law is a service thing. The thing it serves, community, is always changing. So, of course, it's ephemeral. "They recognise the rules exist only because and for the benefit of the society that he served," which puts better what I've just been expressing. "They recognise that rules evolve, grow, fall into desuetude, because of the changing nature of society, changing needs. Most importantly, they recognise that it is their job." Now, if he were here, he would say it's your job, as he accepts it's his job in that important role. to identify, propose, and effect these changes in practice. There's no slacking here, no saying, oh, we leave that to other people. Too hard for us. Theory and practice are to a certain extent indissoluble. They are simply two manifestations of our personality. Now, that's as good a mind in our profession as you can get on this planet. We have other exemplars of this sort of thinking. We have Cassese's Tadic judgment, one of its bits picked up what Hugo de Groot had said in international humanitarian law and applied it to international armed conflict. It's now been accepted. I recently read, I regret to say in English, what Bruno Latour said of his experience with the Conseil d'État. Utterly fascinating, the depth, the wisdom, the vision, some other elements as well, but the thinking is what was going on and the articulation of it in judgments, really giving voice to what matters. Lord Tolson, who very sadly died prematurely a month or two ago, Roger Tolson is the man who used European law to update the law of England and then leapfrogged European law to make sure that the common law was doing the job it used to do in the days of Mansfield 200 years ago, whose work on cross-border insolvency is still cited in the standard text, who invented the insurance concepts we employ. Why did Tolson and why did Mansfield do this? Because society needed it. And I was fascinated to read what the Scot Lord Reed had to say in a very recent address, 13 October, on comparative law, where he pulled some German law, which I hadn't heard of, into the mix. Of course there are things that one keeps idiosyncratic within one's own country. New Zealand has plenty of them, including the All Blacks and Maori values. But there are lots and lots and increasingly more things which need to be done on an international scale. When I was a child, I was a New Zealander. I didn't see myself as an international creature. My children are something completely different. They all live all over the place, travel all over the place. And nowadays, we know that international threats come from all over the place. I'm going to go very fast through my slides because they're there for you to read if you want to. I'm trying to stay to the high ground and also stay within my time. The role of the Security Council, I've signalled, I'm not going to try and educate you people in what the Security Council's duties are under Article 24, what its powers are, under particularly Part 7. They are immense. The point I focus on is the failure, absolutely, despite the advice of Dame Rosalind Higgins, who in my book is one of the greatest lawyers on this planet, they have never got round to taking an advisory opinion from the Security Council on what the word duties in two parts of Article 24 actually means. Dame Rosalind said the court has emphasised that a UN organ needed legal advice in order to know how to conduct its business. Well, of course it does. True, they can take advice, the 15 members of the council and the five big members, from their own people. It's available. But as she says, the greatest role for advisory opinions is where there are uncertainties about the institutional arrangements within the UN. Well, the UN itself, the Security Council, is talking about this topic. If organs are reluctant to seek advice, the court's role as the supreme in-house counsel to the UN will remain limited. Well, the new Secretary General and the General Assembly, bless them, now have, as you know, an Article 96 case currently running in front of the ICJ. It involves issues that went twice to the UK Supreme Court, rather once to the House of Lords, then to the Supreme Court, and it was also a major arbitration. But getting the ICJ fully occupied with these big issues is a must. We can help make that happen. Now, the bottom paragraph of the slide talks about systems deficiencies, and that was touched on admirably yesterday. Excuse me, that's my egg time that I'll just quieten down. In private law, certainly in England, in the common law, the master, the employer, has a non-delegable duty that the business should have a safe system of work. In the case I cite in 1937, footnote 52, the House of Lords held that the employer does not discharge its duty by finding somebody clever to do the job. If the job is not done, then the employer is liable. That's what Wilson's in English decided. A French Nobel laureate and his co-authors commented on the Chernobyl disaster, and I reproduced what they said. I can't get into public law, I have only a couple of minutes left, but surely the Security Council should ask, or be asked to ask, and if it won't ask, or the veto is applied, the General Assembly should refer this question to the ICJ. What are the duties? And I have an attempt, which I'll finish with, as the possible sort of questions that experts, I'm not an expert as to the Security Council, but an expert could devise such questions as, is it the duty of the Council to monitor systematically threats to international peace and security? Devise, lay down, promulgate and implement systems consistent with Article 27 of the Charter, and so on and so on. Has it the legal power to create a crime of terrorism at international law? Well, of course it does. It's already done it. It's done it in resolutions, including a resolution of this year, asserting there to be a crime of terrorism. Time doesn't permit me to go into it. It could either give this work to the International Criminal Court, or there could be an ad hoc, or not ad hoc, a permanent international terrorism court, which could be the better thing, because terrorism can involve small fry things which aren't up to the weight of the criteria of the Rome Statute, but are nevertheless important. If the final matter of ultimate importance is to be achieved, which is that every single person on this planet is to be treated with equal respect, is to be given effect to that right, and until that is done, the law is not doing its job. And it's our task to make sure it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.